Hello, I'm Ken McLeod, Principal Teacher at Unfettered Mind. Our website is an ongoing effort to explain Buddhist practice in a way that is clear and accessible to the Western mind without dumbing it down. If you find these teachings useful, please make a donation at unfetteredmind.org/donate so we can continue to maintain and expand the site. Thanks.
Unfettered Mind, Pointing Out Instructions, Part 9.
Three things for tonight. One is clarifying some meditation points, particularly around emptiness, because people make all kinds of really stupid mistakes around emptiness. Unfortunately, it's not exclusive to Americans. It seems to have been going on for ages, because these stupid mistakes are written up in every Mahamudra text that I've read. It raises questions about the intelligence of humanity. Pardon? Well, I always think, oh, people are so much stupider now, but they seem to have been just as stupid in the past. So. I mean, Charles has been wondering why I'm an apostate. See, there's another one. I don't feel that humanity is evolving.
Do you feel it's degenerating?
No, I don't feel it's degenerating either. All the religious traditions, that's part of their mythology, is that humanity is degenerating. The modernist turned around it into a different mythology and thinks that humanity is evolving to something better. Neither are true.
The amount of violence on the planet is diminished.
Yeah.
Really? after the First and Second World Wars?
Oh, yes, she's quite right.
Can I say that again?
The amount of violence is diminished, and Leslie's quite right. If you lived in a tribal society, if you were a male in a tribal society, the chances that you would be killed by another adult male were about 20%. Unless you were in the Yamamoto and the Amazon, then it was 60%. Yeah. Including both world wars and all of the ethnic cleansing of the 20th century, the chances that you will be killed by another adult, and that's how you'll die, is about 1 or 2%.
Huh.
So when people say this is a very violent age, it's bullshit.
Yeah.
We just do it. But now we have overpopulation.
Pardon?
We have overpopulation as one of our largest problems.
Oh, yes. So we'll kill each other off. Obviously. That will change. You know.
Well, isn't that evolution? Violence is evolution.
I don't think it's evolution in any meaningful sense of the word. I think it's just because nothing has changed. It's just the conditions have changed. As soon as the conditions changed, the violence will be back. You read Collapse?
Mm-hmm.
It takes... Yeah, it's a little disheartening for a society to go from the peak to cannibalism. Two generations at the max. It's usually 20 years. Because you've run out of food. So what do? You start killing each other for food, which is the most common reason for cannibalism.
But all the structures that we have help keep the society safer. I just think you're wrong. I think there is evolution.
You're entitled to your belief. And when people are starving, let's see what happens.
Yeah, well, so yeah, of course. But all the structures that have developed help prevent that from happening.
We're using evolution in two different ways.
Oh, okay.
Has humanity evolved? No. Have they evolved structures to govern themselves? Yes. But has humanity itself evolved? I don't think so.
Do You see the structures as part of...
No, because the structures are dependent on conditions. Take those... I mean, this happens every damn time in business, you know. When things are going well, they bring in all of these consultants, they talk about, you know, getting together and teamwork, et cetera, et cetera. Everything goes really nicely and people are feeling really good about each other and creating this wonderful workspace, and then the economy turns south. And all the people who buy into that, they're the ones who get fired. And the people who are really hard and mean and aggressive and really know how to bring business in, they're the ones that get to stay. Happens every time.
We had a big difference, you know, like IBM in the Depression didn't lay off anybody, for example.
Well, there are exceptional businesses like that, yeah. But I'd say but most businesses, they go through that stuff. There are occasional instances.
There are other countries besides America.
Same thing happened in Japan. Anyway, back to Muhammad. Didn't you see South Park at Blame Canada? Canada's worst. Okay. It's the end of retreat. We're allowed to do this. Mahamudra, meditation.
Can we define Mahamudra?
No. Do you want a definition?
Well,
you would like a definition.
I would like something I can give to other people when they say, "Where did you go? What did you do?" They're not going to understand what I can.
Oh, then you don't want a definition. I mean, definition is not going to help you at all for that, because the term Mahamudra is usually translated as the Great Seal. The seal being, stamp. And what is the Great Seal? The Great Seal is emptiness. Everything is stamped with emptiness. So, you have a choice. Where did you go? I went to study Mahamudra and practice Mahamudra. Okay. Or you can say, I'm going to study the Great Seal. It sounds like the big pumpkin, you know, the Great Pumpkin.
Big wars.
No, I mean, it gets worse, you know. Okay, so just throw out all of that thing, you know what I'm saying? Well, where'd you go? I went to study the emptiness. Okay, so that one doesn't work either. So you can go further. Well, what do you do there? Well, we meditated. What do you meditate on? Nothing. So you're screwed already. My suggestion? I went to New Mexico and looked at the sky. Now, people could probably relate to that. And you're telling the absolute truth. And they say, well, what'd you get out of it? And you say, well, it's pretty good, actually.
So what did I say?
It's pretty good. Yeah, I mean, look at the sky.
We're restful.
Yes.
You went to New Mexico to rest.
Why do you look like that?
Is this helpful?
Yes, it is.
You know?
No more
questions. Okay. Now I'm going to find my place again. Okay. There are various very common mistakes that are made. One is to think that the point of the meditation is to have no thoughts. There are techniques of meditation in which you cultivate thought-free states for arbitrarily long periods. I refer to the jhana meditations and such. And the reason you do that is to develop a capacity of attention. But that's not the point of Mahamudra practice. The point of Mahamudra practice is to experience things as they are. And as one person once said, thoughts are to the mind what sweat is to the body. You know, you exercise the body and it sweats. Do stuff for the mind, thoughts arise. The problem is, as I said at the beginning of this retreat, we take the thoughts to be facts. They consume all our attention. And now we are no longer present in our experience. We are in the world of the thought. And the remedy for that is to develop a sufficient capacity of attention so that when thoughts arise, you recognize them as thoughts, and then they just come and go, as many of you have experienced in your practice. Not only do they come and go, that's one stage of practice, you actually, when you have a sufficient capacity of attention, actually experience them as the movement of mind, like waves on the ocean, etc., many of the traditional analogies. And so now you really know they aren't facts, they're just movement in the mind. And you develop still higher capacity and attention, you come to realize that there isn't anything there which moves. There isn't anything there which moves. It's just the appearance of movement. That's a bit of a paradox, but you can live with it. Okay? No, I know, but it's not okay, but it's okay. Now, so a lot of people will try to generate or create a kind of frozen state in which there is no thought. That is usually virtuous in the sense that doesn't foster reactive emotions, etc. So it's not a bad thing. But in terms of being awake and present in one's life, it's not in that direction, but because you're kind of frozen. A closely related to that is a much more problematic, state, and that is what is referred to as marmot meditation in Tibetan, but we can translate it into gopher meditation. Marmot is a earth-burrowing rodent like a gopher, renowned for sleeping all the time. Just. And there are a lot of people, really a lot of people, that's their practice. They're very still, but there's no clarity. It's a dull state of mind. In the second retreat, our cook, our second cook, the first cook, ran into some problems. It was from a Zen center in Paris. And when he first arrived, he thought we were the most undisciplined bunch of crappy practitioners that he'd ever encountered, because he was used to this stock still.
Zippiness.
No, just stop. Stock still, nothing moves, strong posture, etc., etc. But as we talked with our retreat director and so forth, he began to appreciate that most of the time he'd be sitting there absolutely stock still, no clarity in his mind at all. This, he thought, was meditation. Now, there's a lot of. I'm not saying that that's typical in Zen. I'm just using that as an example. But you find that resting in dullness is very, very prevalent in all traditions of Buddhism. People are warned against it, but because of the emphasis that is put on meditation, people think it's really important to sit there, and if the only way they can sit there is to be in a kind of dull state, then they do that because they think they're doing the right thing. And I, Trungpa Rinpoche, in one of his books recently said, you know, take a break from your meditation, go to a movie, relax. And there's a lot of wisdom in it. Refresh the mind. Because this relaxed, awake quality is really, really important in the Dzogchen and Mahamudra traditions. It's that relaxed, awake quality is the basis for meditation practice. And the dull states and the frozen states and so forth are not. And then there's also the bliss bunnies and people are getting attached to states of emptiness or non-thought or clarity and things like that. So, I didn't bring it. It's in my room. In Arrow to the Heart, my commentary on Heart Sutra, one of the lines in the commentary, some people feel that states of worship states of bliss, clarity, or non-thought. Feeling perhaps, or believing perhaps, that some state will save them. so there's a lot of that. I mean, in Hinduism, there's an awful lot of the idea is to bliss out. That's freedom. And as we were discussing, I think, yesterday, the purpose of generating some of those states is they're very, very powerful states of mind, so you can use the attention in those states to see, to look, and that's the purpose behind the generation of those. And there are many techniques for that in Vajrayana, using transformation of the energies of the body. They're a bit dangerous, so you need to study them with a person who has experience in them. And even then, you can run into quite serious problems. But there's, again, a lot of confusion about people getting attached to the states rather than using them to see how things are, and particularly see into the emptiness of the sense of self and the emptiness of experience. So those are some of the common faults in meditation. Now, there's a whole listing of the eight faults around emptiness, which I've tried teaching from the traditional text a couple of times, and the terminology is difficult. And then I realized that I had written it up in English in my own words in Wake Up to Your Life, so I'm just going to work from there.
What page is that?
Page 420 to 420 and 421. Okay, the first, we call these the four pitfalls. First one, and this is what my opening remarks when I said, you know, people have been stupid for centuries. I have a question for you. Does emptiness exist? How many say yes? How many say no? How many aren't sure?
Okay. About neither. doesn't...
wants to hedge his bets. What kind of work do you do? Okay. Well, if emptiness was a thing, would it be empty? No. So it doesn't exist. How many of you believe in emptiness? You see how it works? Probably I should have asked that question first. This is what Saraha said. People who believe in reality are stupid like cows. People who believe in emptiness are even stupider. And yet there are an awful lot of people who think, emptiness is where it's at. I want to get to emptiness. Have you ever had that thought cross your mind? Okay. Where is it you want to get, Randy? Kind of like thrashing the person who's been infected with the demon so the demon leaves. Like that idea? Okay. So, that's the first thing, to take emptiness as something. And that you're going to meditate on emptiness. They have that phrase in Tibetan, Tongpa Ni La Gompa. And people, emptiness is such a genius of a word. You see, I'm pretty sure it was invented in India. You have to remember that the Indians were also the people who invented zero. Actually, they didn't. There was some stuff before them, but they used it as a placeholder, which was pure genius. Because if you know anything about mathematics, you know, how many of you have ever tried to do long division in Roman numerals? Yeah. This is where you really appreciate this placeholder. So that the principle of being no thing has a lot of power. And emptiness is simply what makes everything possible. And as we did at the beginning of this retreat, we look at our experience and it all seems so real. But when you really look at it, don't groan. The green rectangle. But what a lot of people do is look at the object. But what you have to do is look at the experience. That is, in this case, the seeing of the green rectangle or the hearing of the rain, or what have you. And as soon as you start examining that, it gets really, really mysterious. Because, where does the hearing take place? Well, it can't be out there. And it can't be in here. And it's not clear where in between is. And so you realize you can't actually say anything about it. And that's what emptiness is pointing to, this ineffable quality. That's why it's such a genius of a word, because it just stops the mind. And people have toyed with translating it as openness, which is, really watering it down. It's such a chicken approach to it. And then I did this seminar on the Heart Sutra with this guy from New York. And he said, well, we could call it the void. And void actually is fine, but it's not a word we use. And the thing is that in Tibetan, when you say the box is empty, you say Dongde, Dongpa. Dongpa. So you just say the box is empty. It's actually the same word. So it's quite brilliant. Because you go, huh? And that's exactly what you want. Because the mind stops. And because the mind stops, now other things become possible. So that's the first thing. Emptiness isn't a thing. So there's no point in believing in it. Just in reference to Alan's comment about like what is Muhammad, and I will answer that more substantially this evening. Don't try to explain to anybody where you've been. It'll just cause you a great deal of grief, and it'll cause them a great deal of grief, and nobody will understand. Just don't bother. And there are several reasons. When I first brought up at the beginning of the retreat this nature of experience, several of you said, this is scary. Remember that? Why is it scary? Whenever I talk about emptiness, there's always someone in the room who just argues with me. And for a long time, you know, I tried to argue with him, but it wasn't getting anywhere. He or she would just really just dig in. And then I realized that person was serving a function. Because often the arguments that were being presented weren't particularly rational, but there's absolutely no way to use any kind of intellectual approach to undermine them, because the person would just dig in further and further. So it occurred to me it wasn't rational at all. It was an expression of emotion. And this person was actually expressing the fear of everybody in the group. So that started to change the way I interacted with that. Still happens. But there's no point in having the argument. So, what are you afraid of?
Losing everything.
It's not everything, it's something very specific.
Losing a lot of what we value.
Closer, let's make it more specific.
Losing our identity.
No, actually, people are less attached to that than what they think. Though it's close.
Losing a sense of control over the world?
That certainly can be a factor, yes. I'm thinking of something else. And that is the fabric that holds society together. Because you suddenly feel alone. Very alone. When I was teaching the Heart Sutra class online, I found this wonderful poster. How many of you know of a site called despair.com? Oh, you got to go to despair.com. It is wonderful. Because you have all these demotivational posters. Relationship. Have you ever have you ever considered that the common thread in all the dysfunctional relationships you've had is you? My particular favorite is a picture of a bear in the middle of rapids and a salmon is jumping into its mouth. And the caption is, a journey of 1,000 miles went very, very badly. The one I'm thinking of shows a pine tree on a snowy slope. And the caption is, "Have you ever felt that you were all alone? Well, you are not alone. On the other hand, you are alone. Very alone." So that's one of the fears. It's suddenly like everything else disappears. That's why Karen was on going in the right direction. And like, there's only experience. And people may or may not get that at the conceptual level, but they feel it at some level. And that's the fear that comes up. So this is why I say, don't explain, or even try to explain this, because if you actually try to explain what you've been doing, you're going to stimulate that fear. And that's going to create grief for you and for them. You know, this is the actual meaning of the phrase in the Mahayana Sutras, that emptiness is not to be taught to the arhats and Shravaka Buddhas and Prachekas, Shravakas and Pracheka Buddhas and so forth, because it causes them to have heart attacks and vomit and cough up blood and things like that, because it's so frightening. Okay. That help out?
Yeah.
Can I
agree? Yes, Ken.
How do you look upon the idea with respect to emptiness? That emptiness is when you realize the non-existence of concepts. No. In other words, when you have divested yourself of fixed concepts about your experience.
Emptiness is or isn't anything.
Yeah. No, but I mean the awareness of emptiness occurs when you have cut through the notion of fixed concepts that you project onto your experience. That what's left is emptiness. That's, I think, Alan Watts used to.
Alan Watts expressed things very wonderfully and opened doors to lots and lots of people. He expressed things often very poetically.
Yeah.
Hundreds, possibly thousands, maybe more, were inspired by him.
Yeah.
Forget about trying to define it.
Yeah.
Just forget about that. Because you're trying to take something that is ineffable.
Yeah.
And put it into concept. This does you and everyone else absolutely no good whatsoever.
No, but the way I thought of it was that, okay, if you see through the futility of trying to grasp your world...
What are you trying to do right now? Mm-hmm. You're trying to explain it and understand it. Forget it.
Yeah.
Forget that effort.
Uh-huh.
Know it. And when you know it, you won't be able to put it into words either. Any effort to put it into words, and it takes you away from the experience. This is the discussion I had with Charles several nights ago. And it's one of the great dangers. We're all very intelligent people. We've had very good education. We're very used to putting things into words.
Right.
But whenever we put things into words, we move away from the experience. Don't try to understand it.
Mm-hmm.
Really important. All of these words, all of the things that I've been talking about, and everything that you find in the various texts, these are fingers pointing to the moon.
Mm-hmm.
Don't try to understand the finger.
Mm-hmm.
The fingers point to the moon. You don't even need to understand that it's a finger. All you need to look is in the direction that it's pointing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to pound this one. With a big stick if I have to.
Okay.
Now, second one. Thought or emotion arises. Can you make it empty?
You mean like if you can't
Can you meditate it empty?
Can you make it empty?
It is. It already is empty.
Exactly.
Yeah.
How many of you have tried to make thoughts and emotions empty? How successful were you, Nick?
Oh, yeah, it worked really well. Yep. Did absolutely nothing. It didn't help at least.
You can't make something into what it is already. There's an old Indian adage. You can't wake a person, wake up a person who's pretending to sleep. You can't make a thought or an emotion empty because it is empty. Now this comes back to your point, Kim. When you know the thought or emotion completely, then you know it to be empty. Mm-hmm. Because that is the nature of it. That is, it is simply an arising, doesn't have any substantial existence in and of itself. But this is a form of knowing, not understanding. There's a big difference there.
Okay, so understanding is a lesser...
Understanding, the way I'm using it here,
right,
and people will use it differently,
yeah,
is, you know, when we understand things, we have a conceptual grasp.
A conceptual grasp.
Yeah. To know something...
Yeah.
Is to know it directly in experience.
Yeah.
That's how I'm using the terminology.
Yeah.
It's very, very different.
Yeah.
For instance, you study violin.
Right.
Okay?
Yeah.
Before you started to study violin, did you know how a violin made a sound?
Yeah.
Or did you understand how a violin made a sound?
Not understand it, no.
Well, you understood the principles. Stroke of bow over strings.
Yeah, I knew that, but...
Yeah.
But I didn't... I didn't have the experience of actually...
That's my point. It's one thing to understand how something happens.
Right.
To know it.
Yeah.
Very, very...
That's the direct experience.
The Greeks regarded knowing which did not involve the activity itself was not true knowing.
Hmm.
So this notion of being able to know about something was not regarded as real knowing,
mm-hmm,
in Greek times.
Yeah.
And yet, that is the predominant form of knowing in our culture.
Isn't that also the biblical Semitic word in the Bible, particularly in the Old Testament, when it says to know a woman?
Be intimate with her.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's been a long usage that extended right up until 18th and 19th century.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, in English.
In English.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So your effort and practice is not to make thoughts and emotions empty, but to experience them completely. And there's a very significant difference in effort. Jacob Needleman wrote an interesting book,
mm-hmm,
called Money and the Meaning of Life. He's had a little too much wine in the middle of it, but the beginning and the end are very good. His thesis is that people have problems with money because they don't take money seriously enough. Which sounds a little paradoxical when everybody's always thinking about money. What it means is, and I found this to be true, people don't think about what money actually means in terms of their life. Instead, they kind of take refuge in money. They think that if they have money, then everything else will be fine. You know, they'll be happy and everything will go. And meanwhile, they sacrifice their health, their marriage, their families, etc. to have money. And everything isn't fine. I bring this up as an example because when we take money seriously, okay, what does money actually mean to me? What do I want to do with it? I found consistently that when people say, well, there's not enough money, it means that there's another issue underneath that they're ignoring, focusing on the money. When you really look at what money actually means, then you begin to start looking at what kind of life do you actually want. So by knowing money intimately, you come into contact with what your life really is. And then the answers that arise out of that can be very, very different from what the answers might be if you just said, I need X amount of dollars. You realize you may not need anything like X amount of dollars. You may need to let go of certain ideas you had about things instead. It's the same with thoughts and emotions. We don't take them seriously. We think, oh, it's just a thought, just an emotion, and it runs through our heads and makes a complete mess out of our lives. Do you know how I got started in the Dharma? 1969, graduated from university. I was hanging out with some political radicals in university for the summer, and had a scholarship to do a PhD in mathematics in England. Not terribly enthusiastic by that point, at that point, about pursuing mathematics. And my fiancé had said, I'd like to cycle around Europe. So I was talking to one of my apartment mates and threw out the idea. And he looked at me and said, McLeod, you don't have the guts. Well, that was that. Europe became Turkey, became Iran, became India, and somehow I never got that PhD. Anybody had something like that happen? Well, I got to call up that guy and thank him one of these days. So I didn't take that thought very seriously. I just reacted. I didn't know it for what it was. Probably just as well, otherwise I wouldn't be here now. That's another story. How many of you reacted on the basis of emotions because you didn't know them completely? Yeah, all of us. A lot. We don't take them seriously. Really know them. Because when you really know them, then you know, as several of you have experienced in your meditation here, that there you are, and this emotion arises, and it rises, and you feel it, and then it goes. And when this happens, there's one thing we know. We are not our emotions, because there we experience this coming and going. So we can't be that emotion, because it came and went. That's in the direction of taking it seriously. Now we know something about it, and know it in our own experience. So the next time it comes along, it goes, oh yes, you again. Well, thanks for visiting. So, this is the second one. When you take something in motion and try to make it empty, you're not really knowing it. Third one. Basically, it's a form of name calling. Say, oh, I'm angry. Oh, well, the anger's empty. And then you find yourself committing murder a few minutes later. Well, it may be empty, but you don't know it. And you think that naming it is enough. You know, calling, oh, you're empty. How many of you try this in your meditation? Ah, oh, there's a thought. Oh, the thought's empty. How does it work? Anybody?
Oh, it's like 2 hours later.
Yeah, if it's a tricky thought, he'll say, okay, you just called me a name. It'll disappear, come in the back door and take you over, and 2 hours later you wake up. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you're not going to get anywhere calling thoughts names, like empty, non-existent. It doesn't work. And yet, that's how a lot of people practice and work with this stuff. Ralph.
Yeah, generally when I have thoughts, there's usually an emotion underneath it. And if we're just resting, it's sort of contradictory that you're going to pursue what's underneath that thought so that you can really know it. You know what I mean?
It's the other way around, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah. You see, if you rest, a thought arises. And if it's a thought, kind of thought that's being generated by an emotion, not all thoughts are. Some thoughts are generated by emotions. So, thought, come back. Comes again, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Around the second or third time, you begin to get this little body sensation connected with it. You start resting with that. Oh, a little tight here. A little tight here, too. I got a headache. By this time, there's usually a fairly intense blizzard of thoughts. A lot of physical sensations. And if you're skilled in practice, you know to go with the body sensations and not try to sort out the blizzard.
Mm-hmm.
And as you rest with those body sensations, suddenly you realize, I want to kill him. I'm really angry. It's like, oh. You get the picture?
Yeah, got it.
So when you really rest with your experience, it gives you the opportunity to know what it was. Then you continue, and it goes as before. Feel that anger. And you're in touch with your body, and the thought, and the emotions, and the stories, and just right in the whole experience. It can become extremely intense. And then you notice that you're just sitting there. And what happened to the anger? Now, another question. If you're an emotion, if you're a feeling, what do you want more than anything else?
To be expressed.
No.
To be felt.
To be felt.
Not,
not the same.
Mm-hmm.
Because expressing an emotion or feeling is a way of not feeling it, as is suppression. When we express it, we dump the energy of the emotion into the world. Everybody else gets to experience it. When we suppress it, we dump the energy into the body, or drive the energy into the body. It doesn't really dump. When we just sit in it, we get to experience it. My old office partner was a very angry guy. The kind of guy that if you cut him off on the freeway, he followed you home and punched you out. He was very successful in the business world, not because he was angry, because he really had a very good heart. He does have a very good heart. But he had this anger. And I remember coming into his office, and he was sitting with his feet up on his desk, the scowl on his face. I said, what's the problem? He said, It was a lot easier when I just yelled at people. He expressed the anger. He didn't have to feel it. Everybody else did. Much easier. Okay. So, don't call the emotions names like empty and so forth. Experience them. When you experience them, you will know how they are. Fourth one. This could be summed up in the phrase, meditate now, be enlightened later. How many of you are practicing meditation to be enlightened? Let's be honest now. How's it going? This is like one of those financial schemes where you pay now and with the promise that you're going to get the big reward later that never comes. Like a Ponzi scheme or something like that.
But that is the way that teachers often persuade or advertise the whole...
Yeah, it's the rational choice theory you're talking about. You know, here's the payoff, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Again, this is from my Heart Sutra commentary. What about your mind right now is impure? What about it is pure? Remember in the Heart Sutra?
Yeah.
Not impure, not in, no impurity.
Yeah, not impure,
okay. Right now, what about your mind is pure? Anybody?
Nothing.
Do you know that? How many here know that?
No.
Not a big show of hands. Okay. So, forget this meditate now, get enlightened later. Know how things are right now. That's it. Now, Vladimir the other night was talking about how these descriptions seemed so remote. And we have these extraordinarily flowery descriptions of everything. In the Flower Garland Sutra and many of the other sutras. And they do sound just majestic, totally unattainable. This is high poetry. That's people describing and expressing their appreciation for what they experience. And we need to read them as high poetry, not as that's what we'll attain one day for good enough. Because there's a teacher, Kagyu teacher, I can't remember when he lived, Tulak Trungpa. And in the retreat, I had occasion to read his biography, his autobiography. And one chapter that really spoke to me, which I translated, and it's up on the website, How I Live My Life.
It's up on your website?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And he just says, I've never traveled to the 24 charnel grounds of India, holy sites in the Bhagavad Gita. And I don't know the demons and that terrify people in these sites. But I've traveled enough in my mind to know the demons that dwell therein and the problems that they cause. And he just takes all of the Bhadrayana symbology and relates it to his own experience. It's wonderful. So that's why I translated. I copied it, the Tibetan, during a retreat. It's not that long, but I copied it, and then many years later, when I was in L.A., translated it into English because I just liked it so much. This is how it is. So all of this extraordinarily flowery language and metaphorical language, etc., etc., it's describing how we actually experience things. That's what the six realms is describing. So, as you've heard many, many times, your own mind is Buddha. Know it that way right now. How do you do that? You let your mind rest. This is exactly what Buddha did at the time of his awakening. All of the meditation techniques we do, such as the purification practices and things like mudra and yidam meditations and meditations on the four immeasurables and death and impermanence, all of this stuff has only one objective, and it's to help. Well, you can put it into two ways. One, it's to help build the capacity of attention so that you can actually rest. And the other is to reduce, that's why it's called purification, the stuff that keeps distracting you so you have a chance of just resting. So it's all about creating the condition in which you can just let the mind rest and so how it actually is revealed or becomes evident. So when you're sitting, and this is where Mahamudra becomes very similar to Zen, Soto Zen in particular, don't sit with the attitude, I will meditate now and get enlightened later. Sit completely awake right now. So, Ken, you had a question?
Well, I was going to say, would it be then precise to say, in terms of what you're saying, that rest and recognize? There's a recognition.
Yeah, and that's what I was pointing to yesterday in pointing out instructions. Mm-hmm. In the resting mind, there is a seeing. In the seeing mind, there's a resting. Okay. Mahamudra. This is in the chant booklet, but let me read it to you first. One sentence pith instructions, which actually should have been instruction, I didn't notice the typo. I bow to all holy masters. The mind of the Buddhas of the three times, that to which all the holy ones aspire, the widely renowned Dharmakaya Mahamudra, is nothing but your own mind that thinks about this and that. All experienced, conditioned, and free, is present in this awareness. It is what all the texts, both sutras and tantras, are pointing to. To practice this, do not cultivate anything whatsoever. Let awareness rest free from all elaborations, vividly awake, just as it is. You don't need to worry or think, is this really Mahamudra? Let go of any hope that it will get better or any fear that it will get worse. Don't pursue thoughts that come and go. just rest, vividly awake and aware. Relax completely and rest. Other than this, there is nothing to cultivate and practice. When you practice this over and over again, at some point you will see the nature of thoughts. Then you will know directly that awareness has no ground or base. Attraction and attachment release themselves naturally, and habitual patterns subside on their own. This is Buddhahood. This is what is meant by one moment makes all the difference. In one moment, complete awakening. You have my word that in all the instructions of the Holy Masters, there is nothing more profound than this one sentence pith advice. Please don't show this to unworthy people. When the mystery of transmission is dissipated, it's not possible to connect with the energy of inspiration. Always remember me. There is no mistake here. Rely on the energy of inspiration. And I direct you not to teach this text to anyone unless they have received full instruction in this way. It's written by Rongchen Dorje, the third Karmapa. So, do not cultivate anything whatsoever. Let awareness rest free from all elaborations, vividly awake, just as it is. You don't need to worry or think, is this really Mahamudra? Let go of any hope that it will get better, or any fear that it will get worse. That's a little hard. Don't pursue any thoughts that come and go. Just rest, vividly, awake, and aware. Relax completely, and rest. Okay? Good. That's. Does that answer your question, Alan? That didn't answer me. Okay. I think it was last night or the night before I talked about Chirgompa, the guy who didn't want to be an abbot. Mm-hmm. And here's a song that he sung. I wrote. And I apologize, this should have been included in the booklet. Ralph very kindly was able to make copies for me, so we have, I think, one for everybody, don't we?
Yes.
Okay. And it's up on the website anyway. Vajra Song, Recognizing Mind as the Guru, by Chirgompa, 12th century teacher. Guru Bodhicitta Namami. The gurus who point out mind itself are like no one else. They are done with their own needs and have taken on the needs of others. Their awareness is limitless, their compassion universal. To my kind and precious gurus I bow. Yes, gurus do point out how things are. But the guru who is natural being is within. Mind that is my guru, here is how you are. You have no genesis, you are just naturally present. Misfortune doesn't hurt you, correctives don't affect you. You don't come or go, you don't change with time. And I cannot say you exist or don't exist. I can't see, hear, taste, smell, or touch you. You are not a thing, yet you are the source of all experience. Try as I may, there's nothing I can point to and say, that's you. But when I sit and don't look for you, you are present in everything. You are not subject to conditioning, good or bad. Finer than everything, you don't attach to anything. Not being a thing, you are the basis of everything. Free from reasoning, you arise clearly when I don't reason. Because you aren't anywhere, you arise as anything, anywhere. Yet you don't belong to any one place. So while you are not anything I can point to, you are my guru. What is your spiritual history? Here it is. Because distance doesn't apply to you, you are present in every being. Because of your pure intentions, every being belongs to your family. Because of your great compassion, every being is originally placed in full awakening. Because of your powerful actions, you engage and master everything in samsara and nirvana. Because change doesn't apply to you, even when I look at things the wrong way, what is true is still right there. You've never gone away for a moment. And yet, though a long-time companion, everyone has trouble seeing you. Because death doesn't touch you, you've always been the constant watchman. That's amazing. Oh, mind that is my guru, I meet you by recognizing what I am. I pray to you by letting go of doubt and hesitation. I revere you by letting go and settling naturally. I serve you by resting continuously in the nature of things. I provide you with food by resting without strain and empty clarity. I provide you with drink by knowing attention and distraction make no difference. I clothe you by knowing appearance and sound as enchantments. I seat you on the cushion of non-reactive ecstasy. I crown you with what has always been there but cannot be found. I give you offerings by not doing anything with what arises. Past, present, and future, you always live in the sanctuary of total knowing that holds no identity. Attended by no preference for samsara nirvana, you are constantly giving higher instruction and experience. How amazing you are, mind that is my guru. Again, how kind you are, supporting me with compassion. How much energy you have from practice and earlier training. How amazing you are, your compassion never ends. When I turn to you in these ways, waves of energy wash through me. Without running away, I stop going into samsara. Without going anywhere, I arrive at Buddhahood. I understand that no experience is good or bad. The difference between Buddhas and ordinary beings is direct knowing. When I know directly exactly how mind is and the knowing is full and present, that is Buddha. When one can't do what one can do, then can't be described in words. When I look outside, a guru may teach, but this is what happens. Because I don't know mind directly, I take what is not as what is. Chasing the past, I fall into old habits and pain. That's called ordinary being. Now, let me be my own watchman. As for samsara, I don't chase what is past. I don't let what has happened bother me. A big effort is not to generate a nirvana. I rest in mind itself and do nothing. I cannot identify mind itself as this or that. It arises as I refine this wonderful not knowing. And this understanding is fulfilling. Here's how I know it is fulfilling. Emptiness is just there. I don't need to hunt for the dimension of truth. Whatever appears just arises. I don't need to block the dimension of form. Mind itself is free as it is. I don't need to control the three dimensions of being. Samsara is destroyed at its root. I don't need to discard anything. My mind is Buddha. I don't need to hope for anything. It's always been this way. I don't need to cultivate anything. Isn't this a better way to work? If contemplatives who look at mind without distraction are free from the mind that looks, what's the problem? If deep meditators who continuously meditate on no separation release what meditates, what's the problem? If practitioners who constantly practice with awakening energy understand the natural presence of no practice, what's the problem? If truth masters who carefully guard against managing mind do away with mind itself, what's the problem? I've studied with many capable gurus. Each guru has given me his or her own advice. All advice comes down to one point, mind. So, mind that is my guru, I look at you, listen to you, and seek your instruction again and again. I pray to the seven and kind, gracious gurus. I praise them, give them offerings, and ask for their energy. By doing so, I know directly that mind is the guru. Because this knowing arises internally, when I see writings that contradict or conflict with my experience, I consider the meaning, not the words. This song is the babbling of a crazy man. I don't ask anyone to pardon it. No pardon, and don't offer me anything for it either. Okay. So, here you are.
Thank you.
Hopefully it's enough for maybe one or two short.
It's on the website.
It's on the website, yeah. Okay, item four for tonight. Anybody? Nick needs one up here. Okay. Leslie, do you have one?
Yeah.
Does anybody not have one? I'm going to keep mine away. Because I'll download it.
I think we're seeing the account.
Yeah. Thank you. We have one extra. Okay. We're off. We can't count. So, the day after tomorrow, and this retreat. As I said earlier this afternoon, people constantly ask and talk about integrating their practice into their life. It's something I've been asked about time and time again. And it's a problem. Because when you ask this question, you've already divided your life into two. Now, in all fairness, that division is something that has arisen in the way Dharma has come to the West, partially, maybe significantly, because of the cultural differences, and coming from a largely monastic setting into a largely lay setting. But I know many practitioners, Theravadan, Zen, Tibetan, who at some level feel that they're not really alive unless they're practicing. Which sounds like a completely stupid thing to say, because they're usually practicing a relatively small portion of their lives. And if you practice 3 hours a day, how many of you practice 3 hours a day? Then 12% of your life is practice. So, most of us don't practice anything like 3 hours a day. So to regard that 12% is the only portion of our life that is we're really alive. Doesn't make very much sense. And yet that's very widespread. And that the true life is the life in retreat. And the true practice is the practice in retreat. And meditating and sitting is the true practice. Well, formal meditation, formal practice is very important, there's no question. It's, I think, quite necessary. But this division between life and practice has been very, very destructive. People feel they have to make a sacrifice. They're either going to sacrifice their practice or they're going to sacrifice their family or their work, or something like that. Very, very unfortunate. And I don't think it's a very good way of thinking. As we've talked about quite a bit here, the main effort in practice at which every meditation technique is directed in some way or other, is the cultivation of attention. When we do formal practice, we are cultivating attention unmixed with activity. The rest of the time, we're cultivating attention mixed with activity. That's all. So I gave the instructions for talking. When you talk, you listen to the sound of your own voice as if you're listening to someone else. That's practicing attention mixed with activity, the activity of talking. How many of you tried this? What was it like? Oh.
It was clear. It was kind of strange to hear your own voice.
And?
And what?
And were you able to carry on a conversation?
I was, yes. Like two people talking. It's very nice.
Okay, anybody else? No?
I thought it was a more intimate way of talking, more presence in the conversation. Mm-hmm. My mind didn't wander to what I was going to say as much.
Mm-hmm. Okay, anybody else? Can't remember everybody put up their hands, so just one more. Nicholas?
Yeah, I have a tendency to stumble over my words a lot when I speak, and or just speak more than is really necessary. And I would just say, I don't find that happening as much. There's still a little bit of that, like, feeling of wanting to rush ahead, sort of panicking a little bit, you know. I get nervous when I talk in general to other humans, so yeah, I definitely can feel it.
So you feel all of that stuff at the same time?
Yeah.
Yeah. Good. So that's one example of mixing or practicing attention mixed with activity. And what I said earlier is, don't try to take practice into your life. Because what do we do in practice? Well, often in practice we find things calm down, things sort themselves out, get calm, clear, present. And you try to take that calm, clear presence into life. How does it work?
About 3 days after retreat.
3 days? Hey, that's pretty good.
I found it evolves gradually.
Well, there's a problem. When you try to bring calm, clear presence to a situation in your life, does the situation cooperate? No, it doesn't cooperate. So now you're at war, which is not where you really expect it to be. You have this calm, clear presence. Situation is doing its thing. You got a problem. So this is why trying to integrate our practice into our life doesn't make much sense to me. Now, what if you take life into practice? So you have this situation. You take it into practice. What do you do? Randy?
Deal with it in a calm, clear way.
That might be the result. It's the first step. Charles?
Pay attention to it.
Yeah. Tom?
Experience it.
That's right. You take it into your practice. What's the first thing you do in practice? You rest, you experience what's there. That's what it's all about, right? So that's the first step. Now, what are the chances of being able to work with a situation constructively if you experience what's there? They improve a little bit, don't they?
It's like the beginning.
Yeah. Randy? Right? Okay. There's a four-step method, actually, for working this. And I'll be teaching it this fall power retreat. Show up. So you got to show up in the experience. Open to what is. Notice that's open to what is, not what you'd like to be. Or what you think is there. But what is actually there. Open to what is. Serve what is true to the limit of your perception. We very rarely see and know everything. There's a limit to our perception. But we open to what is, and we serve what is true. Notice that is what is true, not what we want or what we think somebody else wants, but what is true. You won't arrive at that conceptually. You'll arrive at that by opening to what is and sensing directly the direction of the present. And you serve. People are often afraid of doing that because it may cost them something. But interesting enough, this is where Buddhist morality comes in. If you know what the right thing to do in a situation is, and it costs you something to do it, maybe some money, maybe a reputation, maybe a friend, maybe your job, but you know what the right thing to do is, and you do it. How long do you think about it afterwards?
Well, if you lose your job, you might think about it for a long time.
What if you don't do what you know is right?
Then
how long do you think
about it forever?
Yes. Exactly. And that is actually the basis of Buddhist morality. It's not about being good at all. It's about serving what is true.
Now, did you say you're going to teach that?
Yeah. That's the fall retreat.
Is it Mount Baldy?
Pardon?
Mount Baldy?
Yeah.
Is it full yet?
I don't think so.
You said four steps or I only heard three?
Coming to the fourth. You serve what is true. You act. The fourth step is you receive the result. Now, there can be, broadly speaking, two or three different kinds of results. One is, things work out. Cool. Done. The second is, things work out, but another dimension is revealed. Or another factor is revealed. So now you have another situation. Third, it blows up. It's a mess. It was the wrong thing. But there's no way you or anybody could have known that. I had a very interesting experience. One of the people I'm helping to develop as a teacher taught a retreat with me a couple of years ago. It went very well. But the experience triggered something in her, which neither of us knew was there. So she suddenly had a whole bunch of stuff on her plate to deal with. That was very difficult. So you never know. If you have done the first three steps, and you act, serve what is true, and it blows up, you get to see what you couldn't see before. Maybe something in you, maybe something in the situation. I usually find it's something in me. A pattern, a block in my perception that I didn't know was there. The instruction here is you receive the result. That was your reward. So this isn't a guarantee that everything will work out. It is a way of bringing your life into your practice. Because when you work this way, every situation that you encounter leads you into a deeper understanding of how things are inside and out. Okay? So, you go into your lives. This is a good way to approach life. It's a good way to bring life into practice. A few practical points. Those of you who are driving, you've been sitting in a high energy field for 9 or 10 days. A lot of stuff may have shifted inside. Your physical coordination may be affected. So allow a little more space on the road. More generally, this applies to everybody. You may find your coordination a little different. Today I noticed that three people tripped on the slight step into the interview room. That's three more than usual for the last 7 days. Coordination is affected. One of the ways to counteract that is before you pick up an object, touch it. Then pick it up. That way you form the connection, you know where the object is. You don't knock it over or something like that. And this kind of stuff happens. One of my students quietly found herself driving the wrong way on a one-way street. No accident, fortunately. Another student came back from the death and impermanent retreat. His 11-year-old daughter opened the door, and he completely lost it. He turned his wife and said, "What am I doing?" This is the heightened level of energy. So if you can, allow your space, yourself as much space as you can over the next 24 or 48 hours at least. If you're going back into family situations, take some space. Your sensitivity to family stuff may well be heightened. That's often the case. And you may find that you see things that you sort of knew were there, but they didn't hit you. And you may find your heart breaking. That's always a good thing, actually, though it's not always pleasant. Eat good food. It helps to ground. And to the extent that you can, and I know it'll be difficult for some of you because many of you are flying, not being around crowds is really helpful for a couple of days. It's one of the reasons why we end the retreat on Saturday, this longer retreat, because you don't have to go right back into things on Monday. And if it's ended up on Sunday evening, bang, right, work, etc. So taking a day or two in transition, or more if you have the opportunity, is very good. It's one of the reasons I drive to these things. Because I get to drive back. And two or three day transition. And I think I covered the essentials. Really explore doing things in intention. One of the things I like to do is figure out a very simple way to do things in intention, that such as listening to the sound of your own voice. It's very simple, but it does the job. Another one I gave you earlier was when you're walking, feel that you're rolling the earth beneath your feet. Any of you tried that one? How was it?
All good.
Yeah. What do you like about it?
Well, it helped to keep you in the view.
Yeah. And that's very simple. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's the kind of thing to experiment with. Don't need elaborate visualization techniques or things like that. Just see, the thing I like about that walking one is when you, it naturally puts the attention on the soles of your feet, so you have to be in your body as you walk. It's wonderful doing walking meditation, you know. I teach walking meditation.
Right. Some people do walking meditation. So we get these kinds of people.
I've seen that guy. He's always in front of me.
Pardon?
He's always in front of me. Yeah.
And then there's and there's this guy. You know, usually when I'm teaching walking meditation, I say, this is not the ministry of silly walks.
Too scary, dog.
He said, no, no, no. He said, finally, something interesting. So, Cantrell, in his commentary on 7 points of mind training, this is also important. To practice deeply with little fanfare. This is a very, very old tradition. Some of you may have heard the story about Shantideva, who was regarded by his fellow monks as a complete wastrel, who ate, slept, and shat, and did nothing else. Little did they know that he was practicing very deeply all the time. When they asked him, tried to make fun of him by asking him to deliver an annual lecture that they learn as they listen to him recite the Bodhicharitamrita, which was his own composition. Oh, he was not who he thought he was. So there's no need to make any kind of display or tell anybody. I mean, the very worst kind of thing, and this is a Dharma-centered disease. I'm going to be so compassionate that I'm going to give you the opportunity of being patient first.
What?
I'm going to be so compassionate that I'm giving you the opportunity to be patient first.
People say that?
Oh! Nobody's heard this one?
No.
Oh, well, it's said in other things, but other ways, but yeah.
That has happened to me. It's true, I was carrying a bureau down some stairs.
Yes.
At the Dharma Center, getting set up for Kadra Rinpoche's teachings. I was carrying a bureau downstairs.
Yeah.
The bureau was big and heavy.
Yeah.
And the guy was like, hey, be mindful. I almost lost it.
Yes, what you do then is you very mindfully lift it up, lower it with appropriate rapidity on the person's head. And say, thank you for reminding me. Yeah. We get all kinds of stupid stuff like that. So, work at your practice, but don't make a display of it. And then there's absolutely no point in making a display of it. And what does a practice look like? When you're listening to somebody, you listen to them. You actually listen to them. I did a workshop years ago with a group many of the people were from one company that came. It was a little meditation workshop, not particularly deep. But one of the exercises I did was to have people pair up in conversation, and the first part of it was to deliberately ignore the person. So, as the other person was talking, you'd go like this. And then the second one, part of the exercise was actually to listen to them with the same kind of attention that they touched in the meditation. Well, this particular group is really interesting. They were really uncomfortable when people were listening to them. They said, much more comfortable talking to this person when they're ignoring me, because that's how we are at work all the time. Yeah, so busy, you just go on, you're talking about something, nobody pays any attention, they're going on with their work, nothing gets done. You know, happens all the time. So, there's one of my so many stories I could say. So, any questions on any of the stuff we covered this evening? Approaches to meditation, in particular, around emptiness, and not trying to do anything with it. One sentence, fifth instruction in the song of the recognizing her mind as a girl, and how to approach the end of the retreat and the transition. Any questions?
Question. If you were to be in a position to talk about the doctrine of emptiness, shunyata, with somebody that is just coming into Dharma practice, what do you think is a good way to introduce that idea?
Why would you do that?
Well, for example, I have a meditation student. I'm an MI at the Shambhala Center. And his wife is very... she was interested in Buddhism for a while, but then she got turned off by this idea of emptiness, which she equated with vacuity or nihilism. And I've been very unsuccessful in trying to...
Well, the first thing is, it's not a doctrine.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And there are numerous admonitions in the texts. Not to talk about emptiness to people who are not ready.
Mm-hmm. But she hears it from her husband.
Is the husband a student of yours?
Not a student, but, well, I am. I'm his MI. Yeah.
Tell him to shut up.
Yeah.
You know? Because if he's talking about emptiness, you know one thing for sure.
You don't understand.
He's not practicing it.
Yeah. I guess that applies to me as well, of course.
Well, I'll leave that to you. But if he's talking about it, he's not practicing it. Because it's not a bloody doctrine.
Yeah.
It's something we come to as we come to know the nature of experience.
Mm-hmm.
And for most people, their first substantial contact with emptiness is sitting through the experience of emotion in their meditation, whether it's pride or anger or desire, jealousy, it doesn't matter. But there they are, and they sit down and they're consumed by this thing. And the person who's ringing the gong has gone to sleep. And all there is the jealousy, let's say. And the stories. How could she? I'm hopeless, etc. When are they going to ring the gong? I can't stand this. Why did I ever start meditating? I'm never going to come back here. I can't go home tonight. It's going to be too horrible. Mm. Oh, it just goes on and on and on. And the stomach is tied up in the knots. I'm going to vomit. And when is that stupid guy going to ruin the food? And then, for some reason, they just find themselves sitting there. What happened? I was so upset. Kind of nice. Gong. already? Damn. That's people's, most people's first experience of emptiness. So I wouldn't even introduce the topic until they report something like that.
Mm-hmm. I think around the Shambhala Center they talk about it in terms of gap.
They talk too much. That's all. You have a choice, Ken. That's what Eldridge Cleaver says. You're either part of the solution or part of the problem. If you're not part of the solution, you're part of the problem. That's it. Your choice. Any other questions?
I have a question.
Karen.
With your students, do you recommend the same amount of time for meditating to all of them, or do you give different students different amounts of time that they should be sitting?
Why is this of any interest to you?
Because I question the amount of time that I sit.
Okay. How long do you sit?
I cheat.
No wonder you question it. You know you're cheating.
I sit for half an hour every morning.
And?
But then I walk the dogs. And I count that because when I walk the dogs, it's like a walking meditation.
Yeah.
And usually I either do yoga or Tai Chi with a group of people.
Okay.
And I count that.
Why are you counting?
I'm counting up the amount of time that it takes me to become settled, I guess.
But why are you counting?
Well, I feel like, you know, half an hour is really kind of, you know, tacky.
All of those that meditate for half an hour, don't take any offense for that comment. Okay. So. How much time do you feel? Do you want to put into formal practice on a daily basis?
I'd like to put in more time, but I have to, you know, I'm busy. And so I count those other things that I do.
Oh, so it's a way of consoling yourself.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. Walking, Tai Chi Yoga, these are all very helpful. But well, let me ask you one more question. Why do you feel you need to meditate more than you do? Do more formal practice than you are currently doing?
Oh, that gets really personal.
Okay, so you can take it up with me another time. For some people, it's a scorecard.
Yeah.
For other people, they know they need more time. They know what they need to do. So it can be very different. We say we are busy. That's true. But the problem isn't the busyness. This is for everybody. Really. The problem is we don't know what our priorities are. When you know what your priorities are, you make time. and that's it. But when we're feeling conflicted, situations like this, it means we aren't clear about our priorities. So, rather than struggle with more time, less time, get clear about your priorities. What's important? Everything else will fall into place. It always does. Okay?
Can I count walking the dogs?
You can count.
But here's
walking
the problem,
the dogs.
Karen.
I know, that's a joke.
Yeah, but here's the problem. It doesn't make any difference what I reply, because you don't count walking the dogs.
No, I do. I do. In a situation like this, it makes me feel like, my God, I should be doing, an hour in the morning, an hour at night, something like
this. You'll work it out when you get back. That's fine.
Can you talk about doing solitary retreats?
Good point. Solitary retreats are very powerful. Some people find them very straightforward, other people find them extremely difficult. There is no predicting, and the same person may have a simple time with one solitary retreat and a very difficult time with another. So there are many, many different factors that come in. Control advises people to build capacity for solitary retreats in the same way as build capacity for anything. To start off with a day and then do a weekend. Then do 3 or 4 days, etc. And some people jump in. I remember I did 2 1-month solitary retreats many, many years ago. And they were hard and they were fruitful. Thought I knew what I was doing, but I didn't. In doing solitary retreats, work with your teacher and develop a structure for the day. You may or may not follow it, but it gives you something to come back to. A couple of other points. In spiritual work, as in most other areas of lives, but particularly in spiritual work, it's very important to complete your intention. So if you decide to do a 3-day retreat, do a 3-day retreat. If it's problematic, don't leave after 2.5 days or 2 days. This is why you should work up. This also needs to be coupled with balance, though. I mentioned earlier about the mind becoming brittle. When you're in the 3-year retreat, Rinpoche described this as using a Tibetan simile. In Tibet, they carried things from one place to another in leather bags. They had lots of leather because of yaks and zoos and cows and stuff. And they didn't have plastic and not much glass. So it was leather. Well, they would transport water in leather. They'd transport butter in leather. When you use leather to carry water, after a while the leather gets stiff, starts to dry out. And if you don't treat it, it will crack and then it won't be good. But when it starts to get stiff, you start working the leather, kneading it, until it's soft and pliable again. And then you can carry water with it. When the leather is used for carrying butter, the butter gradually impregnates the leather, and the leather gets very hard and very stiff and cracks. But even though you know it's getting hard and getting stiff, there's nothing you can do to rework it. When the mind gets very hard, you don't want it to crack. You've got to keep it pliable. So whether you're practicing in retreat, solitary retreat, or a retreat like this, or a more structured retreat, if you find your mind getting hard and brittle, ease up. If you're in a solitary retreat, work with the body more. Go for walks. In particular, and it's good to have this in mind, go to places where you have a large view. It's very, very helpful. If it's a group retreat, it can be a bit more problematic. So you need to speak with the retreat person. If they're any good, they'll recognize what's happening. But there have been problems where people have been pushed and their mind is cracked, and most people don't recover, is my experience. So it's really not good. And I know many people whose mind is cracked. Practicing on your own in your daily life, stay in touch. Generally speaking, when the mind is getting hard and unworkable, don't work it. Rest. Relax the posture of it. And really just rest. If you can't rest, go for a walk. Do walking meditation. If you're not in retreat, as I said, go to a movie. You know, go out and play. It's very helpful. You know, throw a ball against the wall. You know, you literally play. And you'll know when you can sit again. So it's a bit like working with a dog. Some days a dog, you can really work deeply and train them very, very deeply. Other days, they're not workable. And if you try to work them on the days that they're not workable, you may do a lot more damage in terms of actually training than good. Mm-hmm. So we need to pay attention. We're talking about mind here, but really it's our whole being. The body can get very, very rigid. And this happens a lot. It's interesting. People get really, really tight because they think that's the way that you practice. My own principle is you can push as hard as you want, as long as you stay soft in the pushing. But when there's no softness in the pushing, then you've got to pay attention. That's the warning sign. There's no softness left. You know what I mean about staying soft in the pushing?
I think I know what you mean, but I'm not sure I know what you mean.
Well, you can try it. You can just push against the wall. Mm-hmm. And become really rigid and feel what that's like. Mm-hmm. And then push against the wall. And but stay soft. Mm-hmm. Randy, come here.
Push hands.
I could
do that. You know that?
Mm-hmm. Okay. That's a good idea, Larry. This is a Tai Chi exercise. Just simple.
Oh, I'm going to do it that way. Okay, I'm going to do this way. Judge, she's going to do it from the beginning. Okay. So, I don't know that. So, I'm going to be hard. We're going to do push hands. The push hands, what you do is you just circle. You have a butterfly between your hands. You don't want to crush the butterfly. You don't want to let it go either. So anybody can go anywhere. You just move. And you're doing this so that if you're actually in combat, however the person moves, you're totally in touch with them, but they can never touch you. He's trying to push right into me. By pushing him. It's all that's off now. Wouldn't be surprised. And you can feel when a person goes rigid. See? Right there. If they're rigid in one moment.
Yeah, in just that way. Because as I went into the center, he's not tightening up. So, I'm going to go with you. Watch what happens. Go ahead. Well, there's that, but you can also push straight into me. Right, easy. That's what happens. When you go with you. If I don't go with you, he pushes into me, push straight ahead. Okay. So it's the same as your mind. If your mind goes rigid and you push, that's what happens. Mm-hmm. Fall over.
Thank you.
That's good.
You're going to have to start doing videotaping on your
talk. No, it's my subtle way of saying you should be here. Not everything can be here. Passed on electronically. It's just not possible. Okay. Does that help?
Yes, thank you.
Okay. Other questions? Randy.
Try and ask this quickly. I get tripped up by the modern movement instructions because my understanding, at least lately, today. Experience arises, and that experience can be anything. It's a wild and wacky display, whatever. But the instructions tell you, don't do this, don't do that. What if those things arise? Why do you have to do them, including not do them? Does that make any sense?
I lost something in the middle there.
So,
it says don't do this, don't do that. Like, to lopus menomus on the sen, don't think about the past, don't anticipate the future, don't dwell on the present, don't control, don't examine, rest.
Yeah, you might find your experiences you're trying to control them.
Yes.
Why would you need to do anything with that? That's just more experience, right? You may find that you're not really, you're thinking this is not really Mahayoga. You may have a sense of artifice. That's all just more experience, right? There's nothing you need to do with that either. So I don't get those instructions. I mean, you know, it can go on forever.
You wouldn't happen to be a university professor. There's only two kinds of people who would go on this: university professors and lawyers. Well, is it true?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I thought that too.
But this stuff does arise.
No,
it's
fair enough.
Experience.
Yeah, no, yes, but it's a good question, and. Do you know what it is to rest? A little bit. Yeah. When you're trying to make something happen, are you resting?
Yeah.
When you're trying to make something happening, are you resting?
Well, I could be resting with the experience of feeling like I'm trying to.
Boy, did you throw a lot of qualifications.
Well, it can seem to be happening, you know, but that can be the experience.
Like, yeah.
Oh, I'm trying to do something here.
Yes. When you're trying to make something happen, what's your experience in your body?
Well, before it was tension and dissipation.
And now?
Well, today it was just more experience.
Were you trying to make something happen?
Well, for instance, some kind of weird somatic thing. Or it felt like it, yeah. At least my brain was telling a story. Let me put it that way. I was narrating, oh, now I'm trying to make something happen.
Ah.
But I just left it.
Very different. Very, very different.
Hmm. Yeah, okay. And I guess I could say the same for emotion at the same time.
You're hearing the story as a story, not as a fact. That's why going to the body is so important. The body will tell you whether you're resting or not. If the body's tight, tension, as you say, then you're trying to make something happen. So you let that go. And that's part of the Mahamudra instructions. When you're trying to control your experience, how's the body? Yes. When you're investigating or examining your experience, how's the body?
It's soft.
Pardon?
It's soft.
When you're examining or investigating something,
Yeah. So I'm not watching it.
Yeah. And
okay, yeah. It's yeah, the body's
that's right. When you're thinking about the future, what's going to happen or could happen, how's the body?
Well, doesn't that depend on how caught up I am in thinking about the future?
So you're mildly caught up. How's the body?
It's forward.
When you're thinking about something that happened in the past, how's the body?
Depends what happened.
It was something moderately disturbing. Okay. When you're caught up with something that is happening now, how's the body? Yeah, that's about right.
What's that?
That's about right. So your body will tell you. When you're resting, how's the body?
And it's soft, but for me, there's a client.
Yeah, straight and pliant. So your body will tell you. Anything more?
Yeah, these four maxims of Tilopa, are they meant to be put into effect just in a particular situation of practice?
The six.
Yeah, oh,
six. Six, yeah. There's my mudra instructions.
Right, but is it possible to abide by those in everyday life? I mean, is it meant to eventually get to a point where one has the capacity to live in such a way that those would be descriptive of a person's life? Does a person who has mastered the practice of Mahamudra, would that be descriptive of the way they, at least their inner life, is lived?
Time present is contained.
Oh, wow.
T.S. Eliot.
Yeah.
Yeah. These are meditation instructions.
Yeah. Yeah.
And if you are planning, if you're in charge of planning the construction
right.
of a bridge,
that's what I was thinking.
Then you got to think about some
yeah.
things.
Yeah.
All of that takes place in the present.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
But you got some things to think about.
Right.
Okay.
And you have things to control. Externally, anyway, right?
Well, you've got things to take into consideration. Whether you end up controlling them or not is determined by the event.
Yeah, but your attempt is going to be to control those events because you don't want to lose your job, you don't want to make a bad bridge, you don't
want to... You don't want people to die.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there are things to be taken into consideration.
Yeah.
And plus, I'm not sure what 6 points here.
The six words of Naropa.
Tilopa.
Tilopa, sorry. Not Naropa. Tilopa. Six words of Tilopa. How did I translate them? Don't recall, don't anticipate, don't dwell, don't examine, don't control, rest. It's up on the website. There are two different translations up there.
Thanks.
One of them circulated all over Southeast Asia. I keep finding it on websites in Southeast Asia. The longer version. One version is a straight translation, the other is a bit of a gloss. And a lot of people like the gloss because it makes it clear. So, any other questions? We're way over time. But it's our last night. All done? You're going to let me get away this free? Okay. Let's just sit for 10 minutes. Here. And we'll do the dedication prayers.
Unfettered Mind retains all rights to these podcasts. If you wish to use part or a whole podcast, please send an email to podcasts@unfetteredmind.org.